Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Emmanuel Pastreich. He's the director of the Asia Institute in Seoul, Korea, a think tank that's made the environment and technological change in Asia its central concern. Originally a scholar of classical Chinese literature and more broadly Asian literature, he has advocated for closer cooperation across Asia to address the profound challenges of our age. He's fluent in Chinese, Japanese, and Korean, has recently published a book in Chinese in which he advocates for a new vision of the Chinese economy based in part on traditional Chinese ideas about ecology from Confucianism and Taoism. So first, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Well, thank you for having me, Derek. I appreciate it.
So the first question is, can you give an overview of the state of the natural world in China, and especially an overview of trends over the last 20 to 30 years, say?
Right. So, of course, China is an enormous, it's in a way, it's not even a country. It's like a continent with a billion people, one out of five people in the world. So sometimes to say China is in itself a somewhat Orientalist concept because it's so diverse. However, we can make some general broad comments about the China today and specifically about the environment. And I think you'd have to say first, it's a mixture of contradictory trends, right? On the one hand, China has had very terrible pollution in terms of air pollution, emissions from coal-powered factories, which were encouraged previously on a large scale, the sudden massive increase in the use of the automobile, almost all based on petroleum, and also unregulated manufacturing at the local level, which has resulted in many toxic chemicals being leached into the soil. And then finally, even worse than that, the increasing arid lands, desertification in the north, especially along the Gobi Desert and down into Inner Mongolia and Gansu and heading towards Beijing, which is actually not entirely China's fault. It's a result of the changing climate of the entire globe. On the other hand, China has invested on a scale which is unmatched by any country in the development of renewable energy, has set extremely ambitious goals and implemented them almost unfailingly to increase the use of wind power and solar power, and has shown, because of the nature of its a political and economic system, to be able to implement these moves much more effectively than many other countries. Although there are some respects in which there have been cases in which the Chinese government has been very sensitive about criticisms on the issue of pollution and the environment, on the one hand. On the other hand, there's been a more general discussion about environment, I think, in terms of real policy that can be really implemented than you find in the United States, in which we have sometimes a rather delusional state in which people are somehow, in some vague sense, aware of environment, but it's almost impossible to actually do anything. And finally, I'd say that we have to understand the Chinese situation for the environment in terms of the unregulated global trade system, which has allowed countries like the United States. I'm from the United States, so I tend to talk about your main audience is in the United States, or it's around the world, or do you have a sense of?
Let's say mainly United States, but not excluding the rest of the world.
Right. I have no bias, but unfortunately, I had the misfortune to be born in the United States, and I have a slightly American-centric view, even after living in Asia for 9 years. But in the case of the United States has dealt with very serious problems, environmental issues related to manufacturing by moving factories to China and companies, American companies specifically, have been perfectly happy and even encouraged the skirting of regulations and the undermining of laws on the environment in China. So a lot of this has to do not with China at all, but with the United States and other countries who have used China and the cheap labor in China and the ability to use their economic and to some degree cultural authority to at the local level in China get these practices which have been so destructive to the environment in place. And I guess one last comment would be that very sadly, in fact, it's India which is now starting to take up a lot of the slack. And in the rankings of polluted cities, unbreathable air, now I think there are more Indian countries, more Indian cities than Chinese cities on the list. It's a very tragic global race to the bottom, which I think our descendants will judge us very harshly for.
Well, thank you for all that. And there are so many rich directions to go with what you said. And one of them is you talked about a difference in levels of denial, it sounded like you were saying, about. Yes. And so I would like to talk about that at some point. And another thing I would like to talk about at some point is just some of the – describe physically some of the environmental atrocities that are happening in China, but I think the direction I would like to go first is to read you something that my niece's husband said to me. And I've already sent you this in an email. My niece lived in Beijing for several years and married a man from China, and they were visiting my mom, and Xia Wei and I, that's my niece's husband, went to Walmart. A wonderful, wonderful place, irony. And standing in the parking lot of Walmart, this is a direct quote from my nephew, who I'm my niece's husband, who is not, by the way, politically he and I don't necessarily agree on everything politically. And he says, quote, "All these Americans buy all these cheap consumer goods made in China, and that's been good for the Chinese economy, but not good for the air. In my lifetime," he's about 35, "in my lifetime, I have seen the sky in China go from blue to gray to black. Also, Americans and others can have cheap goods. I understand this is the price we have to pay so a country can develop its economy, but I don't like it."
Right. Well, there are a lot of precedents for this. I mean, if you have done a little background checking, we know that, say, Great Britain in 1950 had a terrible air and a lot of pollution, and that Tokyo in the late 60s, early 70s had terrible air, actually worse than what you say find in Beijing today. And there is a general assumption in China that there's like a passive, sort of rite of passage of economic development. However, the scale in China plus the end game of climate change means that this is just not like those previous cases, although we're all responsible. I mean, it's in the case like talking about whales, right? So Americans are very angry, or many people in the West are very angry or irritated that Japanese, for example, fish for whales and kill whales every year. And that's understandable. It really is unfortunate and a mistake, considering that whales still face many challenges and their numbers are not that great for Japanese to continue whaling. However, to blame Japan is ridiculous, right? Since it was the United States which slaughtered 85% of the whales in the world and made enormous profits, which had a lot to do with economic development in the United States. So this is part of an ongoing pattern. I think maybe the most essential part, we tend to at the beginning think that environmental issues have to do with emissions, policies, regulations, and renewable energy potential, et cetera. But in fact, ultimately, it's an issue of culture, right? That this idea that you could, evaluate, assess the strength of the economy or economic growth in a short term without any consideration for where you would be in 20 or 30 years, the sort of seventh generation principle of the Cherokee Nation, and that you could do so without actually assessing the impact on the global ecosystem of cheap production is so irresponsible. I mean, we all do it because it's so becomes such a profound part of our culture, but it's so incredibly irresponsible. And I wrote an article about now, I guess, 7 or 8 years. I wrote several articles on the question of basing currency and assessing the state of the environment, so that if you have an assessment for the United States of like economic growth or GDP for a year, that you should have an equivalent statistic for the state of the ecosystem for that year. Everything, your calculation of growth should take into account all these consequences. And there have been several articles written recently in which people have said that essentially no companies are profitable if you take into account the total impact on the environment and the total impact for future generations, that everything we're doing is not sustainable. I think that it's really tragic, sort of sad, I think, because in a way this somewhat fraudulent view of what economics means, Chinese have also to some degree, as you were mentioning, with your brother-in-law, was it?
My niece's husband.
Niece's husband, sorry. Has also both is frustrated, rightfully, with what he sees, but at some level also accepts many of the underlying principles. And if you look at Chinese economic policy, agricultural policy, how the environment was viewed traditionally, say in the 17th or 18th century or before, Chinese extremely effective in organic farming, took long-term views, did not accept the short-term approach to assessing economic development, and did not agree with a consumer-based system, right? The traditional Chinese values, economic, sort of social, ethical values, were on restraint seeing low consumption and renewability as an ethical imperative. That's really traditional China. So in a way, to look at China and say, oh, China's doing all these bad things that the West isn't doing is hypocritical and it's wrong in multiple levels. One is the West, so-called West, whatever that means, the U.S. is outsourcing things to China, so it doesn't have to deal with the consequences of manufacturing. It doesn't have to make the innovations and changes in its society and economy that it needs, on the one hand. And the second is underestimating the fact that the actual solution to the problem may lie with adopting many of the principles and approaches and policies which come from traditional China.
So I want to come back in a moment to ask what happened with I mean, obviously a lot of things happened between the 18th century and now. But so what happened to that land ethic? But before that, I want to really hammer this notion that you've said a couple times about it's so easy sitting here in California for me to go, oh, those damn Chinese. I mean, the sky is black and the rivers are devoid of fish. And there are places, this is true, there are places in China that are so polluted that there are no pollinators. And that's completely horrifying. And so it's very easy for me to sit here in this redwood forest and say, oh, those terrible Chinese who are doing that. But then we come back to, I'm thinking about global warming, for example, where emissions are counted for the country where the emissions are actually set into the air. So if I buy the most groovy solar photovoltaic system in the world, and now generate electricity, and I am the most righteous person that has ever existed because my carbon footprint is zero, but it ends up that this solar photovoltaic system was produced, manufactured in Baotou, China, so they get credit, they get negative credit for the emissions, and I get the joy of being groovy.
Right, there are people, as you know, who fly around in their jet planes and say, oh, I have a negative emissions because of their, you know, the way they calculate, you know, they give money to certain charities, which is a truly grotesque. So it has to do with trade, and it has to do with this outsourcing policies. But maybe the most fundamental part is that we really do live in a different world. I mean, that we've come together for better or worse. I think primarily, and this is the other part of what I've talked about, the rapid exponential rate of technological development, which means that it is really one village, one community. Everything you do here affects everyone there. Outsourcing it to Balto does not help you in terms of climate change in any way. You're fully responsible for it. But we have a whole sort of, what do you say, the industrial advertising complex whose entire job, way of making money, is by obfuscating these truths and convincing people of shallow fantasies about what we're doing and what we're not doing that allow them to live in a world of denial. And the United States is suffering. I think it truly is tragic, the degree in which the culture of denial has, I mean, not just regarding the environment, on every level, there's a culture of denial which has become extreme pervasive, and advertising firms and political consulting firms, their primary product that they're selling is ways to encourage denial. So it's very, very serious, and the Chinese can I say one more thing on
this? Oh, please.
Regarding, so another issue which has come up, which I've noticed many, many times, is it's not just the United States. I mean, we find this in, you know, the Scandinavian countries, in Europe, people very self-righteous, unaware or intentionally unaware. They're certainly capable of knowing that the products they buy that are imported impact the environment, and also knowing that that many of us have had good educations, we have some knowledge about these issues. There are not, as someone who's worked with China quite a bit, it's very possible to have your materials on the environment translated into Chinese to engage people in China or India or other places at the local level to spend, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to try and bring these values to those countries. Most so-called environmental, you know, organizations in the U.S. spend almost nothing on working on China directly. And I find this rather disturbing. And secondly, is the United States itself, or for that matter, other countries, including Korea or Japan, are creating a model for what China does. And it's actually to China's credit that in spite of witnessing this incredibly terrible model for economic development from the United States, that they've been able to break away from that, you know, petroleum coal-based system and start to take serious steps towards renewable energy, although they still have a long way to go to as well, because they've seen manufacturing as being core. The United States has rather moved into a financial economy, which has had a terrible effect, not just on the employment, but also, I think, on the general ideology of the country, because finance is so, by its nature, speculative and ephemeral and doesn't focus on long-term projects. And China's at an advantage that in that respect, and the government of China actually has science policy. It may be wrong, but it has a science policy. It can make 30-year plans, and tragically in the United States, for example, with the development of electric batteries, the Navy, the United States Navy and the United States and Army have made tremendous progress in the development of electric batteries. And so why is that happening in the military? Because the military is the only part of the government in the United States which is capable of offering firms or organizations 30-year contracts, right? So if you want to move to renewable energy, you have to make a 30-year plan. But in fact, the United States, tragically, the military is the only part of the economy which is capable of doing that. China, however, can do it.
So let's back up a second, and I wanna bring you back to something you said earlier about there being a race to the bottom with in terms of pollution. So and we of course see the same thing in terms of wages. We see the same thing.
Yes.
When you have this absolute mobility, well, I guess capital isn't absolutely mobile because you can't really move a factory. It's not so easy. But when you have relative mobility of capital.
And it's been seen as a virtue to do that. I mean, essentially.
So how I know that this is sort of off topic and way too huge, but what in terms of specifically outsourcing pollution, which is what we're talking about, in terms of outsourcing pollution, the global economy, and a race to the bottom, what given the current international social structure or whatever, what can be done about that? This isn't a wind down question yet. This is, you know, I'm just, what can be done about this constant race to the bottom?
Right. So there are other people who've written about this more profoundly and more in a much more informed sense than I have. So I hope you'll forgive me if what I say is, it seems like a caricature of what others have said. But I think it's still valuable to articulate the general question. So first is that we have now global institutions which are basically undergirded by, supported by financial concerns. So at one level, we do have some global systems. But they're financialized, and as you know, if you want to help someone in some other country, environment, whatever, you can only do it in terms of money, and it's never, almost never, is some issue of behavior brought into the equation. And that includes things like the United Nations or UNESCO, whatever. They want you to give them money, right? But they're not interested in changing practice, or they don't do it in any serious way. And that's, I think that's been a crippling aspect of our globalization project. Globalization itself, cooperation or communication between people around the world, is not bad. It's good and absolutely necessary. But sadly, that dialogue has been underwritten and dominated by certain concerns who benefit from this particular approach of outsourcing. They go parallel, right? The low wages and the outsourcing of pollution. How do you stop it? Well, I think if you take the sort of Gandhi approach to it, it would say you stop it by first changing your own practice, which I think if you try, which I have, you'll soon discover is really, really hard, right? I mean, if you decide, for example, you don't want things wrapped in plastic because you're concerned about climate change, right, and the use of petroleum, you're going to find it hard to live, right? I mean, every single act becomes a criminal act. In a way, some of us have gone through that. I'm not sure if that's the way you should live, thinking that every single act is somehow participation in a sort of a criminal conspiracy. But I think that that awareness is maybe the first step, right? That every single time you pick up something made out of plastic or imported, and that every time you concerned only about your local situation and not aware of the way in which the entire biosphere is connected, that what happens in China affects you, what happens here affects China, that's the first, I guess, real step. And in the United States, we have so many people climate change, this is the larger question, climate change. But we're really facing the biggest question is just denial culture, right? That you don't, it's so big, it's so challenging, and it goes to the roots of everything that we assume is essential to how the world works, that vast majority of people would prefer just to say, I didn't know this, right? I'm not even aware of it. I don't want to think about it. And so it's a very painful process to sort of force oneself to change one's own behavior patterns. I can go beyond that and say ways in which you can cooperate, emphasize local economies, but have them linked globally with parts of networks, set up systems for assessment so that you have statistics about what the state of the environment is, and those are presented so you don't just get, you know, economic growth rate of 5.2, but you also have a rate for, you know, what the state of the environment is, or that the growth rate has to include within it all the economic, the environmental impact of what you're doing both locally and globally. But that part I'm less expert on, and in a way you can't really get to that until you first get the sort of the change in terms of people's thinking, their behavior, their sense that this issue is not an abstract one, it's a profound ethical one, and it has the, I always hate to use that, you know, moral equivalence of war, because war, of course, is part of the problem here. But there is something to that in the sense that the demand for sacrifice, commitment, and a total sort of transformation of the economy. I mean, it's of course what people like Jill Stein have spoken rather effectively about it, is really essential. In the case of Jill Stein, of course, her sort of 30-year plan for renewable energy in the United States is way too slow. We'll be lucky if we survive following that sort of a directive. So it's tragic and very frustrating to see just how slow we have been in coming to terms with this crisis.
So let's talk for a moment about, and I'm not asking you to do the last 350 years of Chinese history, yeah, but can you give a couple of mile markers along the way for Chinese philosophical transformation from a way of living that was not so destructive of the land, right, to what we see currently.
Right. So let me first say that the Chinese traditional organic farming, irrigation, land and soil conservation policies, and it was also true, of course, in Japan and Korea, were distinctly effective. Maybe it was the best, the most sophisticated, civilized, sort of complex bureaucracy, including advanced manufacturing, which was essentially 100% based on organic farming. So it's a model. It's not something just from the past, but it's probably a model for what we can be in the future. There's a famous scholar, F. H. King, he was a professor at the University of Minnesota, and he went to visit China, Japan, and Korea. He wrote a book called Farmers of 40 Centuries, published in 1910, I think, in which he said then the United States should model its agricultural policy on what's done in Asia. This is the tail end of the traditional agriculture in Asia. So it was very, very impressive and includes, of course, complete, real recycling as opposed to sort of ersatz recycling. Anyway, so the biggest sort of landmark in the history is the Opium Wars. In the Opium Wars in the 1840s, and they continued on what was called gunboat diplomacy later, the Great Britain had a trade deficit with China because China produced tea and chinaware, and Great Britain couldn't sell anything to China, so they started selling opium. The Chinese tried to stop them from selling illegally opium in China, and the British responded by bringing in their newest battleships and weapons, cannons, and they were able to completely destroy their Chinese opponents and force upon China a humiliating set of unequal treaties, which made parts of China into sort of semi-colonies, and that continued. I mean, with Hong Kong, it continues in part to the present day, but of course, much has been recovered. So what was the effect of this? Well, first, in terms of military strength and technological development, China and England were not that far apart 40 years, 50 years before that. So what had happened was you entered the Industrial Revolution, and the rate of sort of technological and industrial change starts to become exponential, and you get this enormous gap. So China, ever since then, even today, is profoundly aware of how the West, with its advanced technologies and its aggressive global trade system, able to humiliate China and turn China to a semi-colony. And there's concern that this is, of course, going on to the present day, and that undergrids many, many policies and attitudes. And by the way, I think it's not totally wrong, because although things have changed since gunboat diplomacy and the Opium Wars, there still is a group out there in Great Britain or the United States who are thinking in those mercenary terms. So the next stage was...
So part of that was basically fool me once, shame on me, fool me twice, shame on you. It's like invade me once, shame on you. Right. Invade me twice, shame on me. It's not going to happen again. Is this what you're saying?
So we have to develop economically. We have to adopt everything. So this is what happened from the 1890s on. Chinese were trying to import all these American or European institutions, factories, trains, coal-based, power generation, et cetera, everything. In fact, all the books I read when I was studying Chinese as an undergraduate in the 1980s always would talk about, how China had failed to modernize was forced to sort of rethink its economy and its philosophy, et cetera. And the West was a model, and all the scholars from the, especially 1950s and 60s, had their hands up in their air saying, how was it that the Chinese, who were so well-educated, were unable to achieve this modernization agenda, which is an imperative for anybody to be successful in the world and ushered in our wonderful modern world. Now, looking at it in the 2016, it starts to look a little bit different. You wonder, or I wonder, whether maybe the Chinese model was actually the right one, and this Western model was a short-lived, extremely destructive concept of economic growth, which left out the most important point, which is the ethical imperative behind all economic activity. So China went back and forth. It industrialized in the 20s and 30s, but ultimately, of course, what we see now is based upon the socialist economy of the People's Republic of China from 1949, which has, of course, been modified, but some basic tenets are in place. Socialism was practiced in People's Republic of China. It can be evaluated in various ways, had some successes and also great failures. I think we must recognize that it did not consider environmental issues to be a primary ethical imperative. And yet, if we look at, say, China in the 1970s, I mean, everybody was riding bicycles and the skies in Beijing were blue. This is what your friend, in-law may have been referring to, his own childhood. And so there was not that, China did not start down the road to becoming the factory for the world, right? That was really from Deng Xiaoping. This Mao Zedong, of course, being the leader from 1949 until, 1974. And then after that, Deng Xiaoping, increasingly, it's seen as a way to make income and make China strong economically and bring in new technology and opportunities to open the door for factories from places that want to find it cheaper to produce in China, i.e. they can enjoy the goods without having to pay the wages, and also strategically undermine labor in their countries, and also, of course, to get around the paradox of environmental impact. Manufacture for near free things out of plastic or metal without having to pay the price in terms of pollution. So that has gone on. In the case of China, it's a complicated equation. I think parts of China itself is split. I mean, there are lots of people in China who are very ambivalent or opposed to these policies, but there's also a lot of money to be made. Both the United States and China are increasingly similar in the domination of certain extremely wealthy individuals or groups who are able to ignore the interests of ordinary people. But I would say overall that the trend has been, because of the enormous outsourcing which took place in the 80s and 90s, the United States looks a little bit better because it doesn't manufacture anymore. But that the trends right now over the last, I'd say the last 6-7 years since the Chinese government set this as a priority, to move to renewable energy, the trend in China is much more positive than the United States. The United States is really doing nothing in terms of rapid transit, in terms of wind power. I wouldn't say it's not doing nothing, but it's not doing anything compared to what it could do. And tragically, the United States has embarked in this enormous investment in fracking and other approaches to wanting to become the Saudi Arabia. I mean, they literally say this, you know, to be competitive with Saudi Arabia, which is just a nightmare world for the poor United States to think. I think anyone just so profoundly irresponsible to think the United States is not going to be Saudi Arabia. Fracking is not going to last for more than 5 to 10 years before the terrible consequences of it force people to reassess that decision. But I think China, there is fracking, by the way, and fracking with American cooperation going on in places in China as well. China hasn't been spared from that. But there is, although China is maybe worse than the United States overall, there is a central-driven effort to move to renewable energy, which you don't see in the United States. And that there have been many people who have said that China has the potential, although the jury's out, to move to the next state. That's to say, if you think of the transition, Great Britain rose in power based on coal. United States rose based upon petroleum, and maybe China would rise on the sort of massive use of renewable energy. But that's sort of a fantasy about the future. What we hope would happen, we still don't know. The awareness among ordinary Chinese about environmental issues is increasing very, very rapidly.
So I'm gonna ask you a question that's kind of a non sequitur, but
please,
this is bugging the hell out of me. during your last answer, I was listening to you, and at the same time, I picked up a travel alarm and looked on the back, and it says "Made in China." And then I picked up a blood pressure cuff, home blood pressure machine, which said "Made in China" on the back. And then here's some cough medicine that's actually made in India, so we'll leave that aside. The point is, what? And here's a lamp. Actually, if you look on the bottom of the lamp, it says "Made in China," and. I mean, I knew that China made a lot, but do we have any idea for the numbers? And I know, obviously, there are, I mean, in we'd have to be very careful in figuring out the statistics, because a person in because the United States probably relies more on imports from China than does, say, I don't know, Botswana or something. But in terms of – but what percentage? Do you have any idea what percentage of the plastic – the computer here is made in China too. So we got right. Three Chinese things right here. What percentage of – this all jumped up because you said something about – I don't know if you used the phrase factories of the world. Was it with Deng Xiaoping, the guy
factory
after Mao?
For the world. Deng Xiaoping.
Yeah.
Factory for the world.
So how true is that, that they're the factory of the world?
Well, India is making a big systematic bid to take some of that away from China. I don't know the statistics, but the peak for this was, let's say, 7 or 8 years ago. But then now, Southeast Asia, India, and other parts of the world are starting to pick up the slack because the cost of labor in China has gone up. Also because there's, you know, organized demands for better conditions for workers. And also there's more complaints about the pollution and its impact, and more environmental awareness in China. So you can't really get away with what we did previously. There's a book called Chindia about China, India, and their global economies, and how the whole world is being remade by these two. And they're, of course, based upon this system is based upon the assumption that transporting things around the world is free or near free, right? It's by externalizing or ignoring the environmental and or other costs of using petroleum for transportation. In the United States, in the most extreme example, you have these cases recently that came up in which chickens are grown in the United States, and then they're killed, frozen, and then shipped to China, and then in China they're processed, right? Skinned and whatever, cut up into bite-sized pieces, and then they're shipped back to the United States, right? So just for the comparative advantage of low wages in China, the United States is taking its chickens and shipping them, you know, in freezers to China and then bringing them back. So that's I think unprecedented in world history. We've never tried to do anything quite as crazy as that. And it's in some respects getting worse. I see in the United States and in Korea now, I'm not in the United States as much anymore, but people consume things, throw things away with sort of reckless abandon. I mean, you would have thought that at this point in the game, people started to say, hey, you know, it's a crime, you know, buying something wrapped in plastic, throwing something away, going through five umbrellas in a year, you know, or 10 or whatever, that this is just wrong. It's ethically wrong. I have to stop it. And yet we have not been able to make that first brave step to say, I think the first step is to say that economic, environmental issues are ethical and that every aspect of your life is part of that. And we have to start at, you know, immediately, right? You know, with one's own actions.
So we have about 4 or 5 minutes left. Mm-hmm. And another tall order here, just like we just had you do 200 years of Chinese history in 30 seconds. Can you, in the last 4 minutes, give you are suddenly, tomorrow you wake up and you have been declared the leader of the Chinese economy, or the world economy for that matter.
World economy, yes.
And because they're all interdependent in some ways.
Right.
And so what is your, you say you advocate for a new vision of the Chinese economy based in part on traditional Chinese ideas about ecology from Confucianism and Taoism. So you are put in charge of the Chinese/world economy tomorrow. Right. And what do you mean by this new vision that you're advocating?
Right. So, I mean, I have written about, you know, the direction, and I don't think the ultimate direction for China is different than it is for the United States, that the United States and China have a lot in common, although, of course, the United States is more finance and China is more manufacturing. But that's going to have to change in the future. The United States has to go back more to manufacturing. There are several things. First is to make the ethical imperative in the economy, and specifically because the economy impacts all the environmental issues are related to economy, to make it visible and make it center stage, and to calculate economic, and this has been written about at great length by others, visible, so that you, when you figure out you want to build a factory or buy something made out of plastic as a gift, it's figured into the price, the total cost of it, and also that there are supports for this. I think also in the case of the United States, of course, and to some degree in China as well, we have to realize that the enormous amount of money that we spend on things like fighter planes and aircraft carriers is going to have to end. These things, these objects are totally useless against climate change, and we just don't have the money because we're going to be spending, you know, trillions of dollars to try and stay alive over the next 40 years. So we have to, I think, quite radically change the economy. I hesitate to summarize the details of it because first I didn't really prepare for that, and there are others who have done a much better job. But I would suggest going back to traditional economies. China is, I think, maybe one of the most sophisticated, say, Chinese economy in the 18th century or 19th century, because compared with what was happening in Europe, it was still, wasn't predatory in that sense. And trade in China was less predatory. I mean, in the West, they tended to be moving in with colonialism, especially in the 18th and 19th centuries, to securing resources overseas, holding colonies, and bringing it in to make income, and that analogy, sort of like taking something where you can't see it and getting value there and bringing it back, affected the whole approach to the economy. So we can learn an enormous amount from traditional approaches to economics. The term in Chinese for economics is, or economy, is jingji, which comes from the original term is jingshi jimin, which means to support oneself through the year, and also to help the people as a sort of a moral imperative. So the original Chinese concept of economy was never detached from the idea of a moral or ethical imperative for what should be done. So I think that we would do very well to bring that back in every aspect of our approach to economics and environment, which of course the same thing, really. I hesitate to say we should do this particular policy, because I think once you have that other part in place, right, then the policies and the approaches and the technologies derive from it naturally. It's, on the other hand, if you don't have that in place, if even the most progressive, open-minded people are still using GDP to assess the economic strengths, if they're dependent upon petroleum for their, their TCI CREF retirement funds, if they're sort of embedded in this nightmare economic system, whether in China or in the United States, then it's impossible to go to the next stage.
Yeah, I completely agree. So do you have, like, in the last 30 seconds, do you have anything you'd like to sum up that people should know?
I think we should take China seriously and engage with Chinese. I mean, nothing could be more valuable, and is now more discouraged, than actually talking with Chinese, citizen to citizen, organization to organization, about what we're going to do. And the Chinese I've met have been very open to this. I think it's a myth that the Chinese are closed and not willing to engage in a serious discussion.
Well, thank you so much for this, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Emmanuel Pastreich. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.